committee will come to order, and welcome. We appreciate you being here today. We're going to have a informational meeting on something that I've been hearing about for a long time, the evidence-based prescription drug reviews, improving drug use safety and applications and information. So introduce yourselves and we can get started.
Well, I'm Mark Helfand from the Oregon Evidence-Based Practice Center at OHSU.
Okay. I just want to say that this is a subcommittee meeting right now. When we have another member, we'll open up to a full committee meeting. But, so would you like to proceed, please?
Well, I'd like to give you a little information about the Evidence-Based Practice Center's role in the drug projects and what we do. We're distinct from the policymaking side of the project, that is, the groups that make actual decisions. We produce evidence reports. The Evidence-Based Practice Center was created in 1997, and essentially what we do is summarize medical information from scientific studies. Since 1997, we've worked with a large number of clients or partners, some of them federal, some of them at the state level. Several years ago, we began to work with the state of Oregon on the Drug Effectiveness Project. But in all the cases, with all of these kinds of clients, our procedures are similar in this respect. We don't make recommendations for practice. We just summarize what the scientific evidence is for others to make recommendations for practice. And I'll probably repeat this several times today, if I can. We don't endorse any recommendations based on our reviews. What we do is we endorse our reviews as a fair, balanced summary of the medical scientific evidence. And as you'll see later, we offer that as part of a any deliberative process on the evidence. Systematic reviews are comprehensive, systematic, open-minded reviews of all the evidence. The principle is that the evidence should determine the conclusion, not vice versa. That is, not let's cite the papers that support our personal preformed opinion, or not just use evidence when it's in favor of our opinion, when it's positive, but not use it when it's not. Rather, look at all the relevant evidence, and then see whether it backs up different opinions. Now, when I mention this about citation of papers, the typical process for making decisions is for advocates to come forward and say, we think this is the best alternative, or we think that people ought to be treated this way, and to cite a few papers that support their opinion. But there may be other articles of equal merit that they're not bringing forward to that deliberation. The main role we have is to bring forward all the relevant evidence, not just that selected to support a particular point of view. So systematic reviews, it's pretty simple. They're systematic to remove bias in finding and reviewing scientific information. Experts also bring a lot to a deliberative process, of course, but they may often just select the evidence, as I said, that supports their opinion. And also, experts are good at judgment issues. They're not always good at number issues. This is a survey of experts' estimates of breast implant rupture rates from some material David Eddy collected. These are different experts' estimates of the effect of colon cancer screening on the chance of dying from colon cancer, ranging from close to 0% to almost 100%. And I'll skip the next one. So that's why we're systematic, to avoid bias in bringing forward information. The other point of a systematic review is to emphasize the best evidence. The best evidence addresses health outcomes rather than intermediate outcomes. For example, in asthma treatments, We'd rather see studies that look at whether people at outcomes like mortality or whether a school kid can do well in school, get good grades, than just evidence in the ARC-B there that looks at some measures, for example, in FEV1, how much air they can expire in a minute. That measure's important, but it's not a health outcome. It's not something the patient can actually feel or experience. So we emphasize as much as we can health outcomes, things in that lower box. The best evidence is practice-based and applicable to real patients, and it considers the potential harms as well as the benefits of the intervention being considered. And finally, it's from well-designed, well-conducted studies. So when we look for evidence and when we summarize it, we try to emphasize evidence that brings out these characteristics. Now, evidence-based medicine, one definition, is the integration of best research evidence with clinical expertise and patient values. Our reviews define the strengths and limits of the evidence and try to make estimates of important outcomes. And they clarify what statements or claims are based on evidence and what's based on other grounds. But they do not necessarily tell you what to do when the evidence is limited. Other factors such as equity, clinical judgment, values, and preferences play a role in using the evidence. That's why our reports by themselves are not the decision makers. They're used by decision makers who bring to bear their experience, their medical knowledge, their experience as patients, the kinds of groups that in Oregon and other places are using our reports. And that's important. We are happy if in the deliberative process about which drugs are better or which treatments are better, people are clear from our reports on what's based on evidence and what's not. But we don't make decisions for them, and we don't make recommendations. Different decision makers may come up with different decisions based on different values, and that's appropriate. Let me just talk about the drug class review project for a minute. We think that systematic drug class reviews should address questions that reflect clinicians' and patients' concerns. So in our process, we have an effort to extract what are the important questions that underlie uncertainty. What's important to patients? What outcomes should the literature, should the research study? And often we contrast what the research actually does and studies with what people want to know. And a lot of times there's a big gap between what people want to know and what some of this research actually studies. The actual measures they look at, those kind of things, are based on regulatory requirements from the FDA, and they're based on convenience and the fact that it's expensive to do studies. Often what we do is start with the questions that should be asked, not the questions we know the literature answers, and bring out the contrast. We think that decision makers should begin to wrestle with the idea of what is good evidence. That manufacturers that produce clear evidence of superiority over other drugs in the class should be rewarded in the marketplace, and that new research should respond to information gaps identified in the process. I'll skip the pitfalls for a minute, but the strengths of the process from our viewpoint: the pharmaceutical industry has been responsible and active. They engage in debate on effectiveness and harms, not on factoids and sound bites. They believe in their products. And the process that we use, which is derived from the standards set by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the federal agency that certifies the 13 evidence-based practice centers, is well suited to the task because we pay a lot of attention to getting the questions right, and we make sure that what we do is broadly peer-reviewed, in this case by the public. We put these reports out there for anybody to comment on, and then we use that feedback to try to improve our reports. And I said I'd return to the issue of our independence. The Evidence-Based Practice Center, as you've seen, has been around since 1997, 1998. The center, first the state of Oregon, and then the Center for Evidence-Based Policy are among our clients. We do reports for them just like we do reports for the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and other groups. But we can't be in a position to endorse or not endorse anybody's decisions based on our reports. Because these reports are out there for the public to see on our on the website, anybody can use them. And, of course, it's possible to use them well or misuse them. We can't really control that. What we can control and what we're most interested in is updating, maintaining, and improving the quality of our reports so that responsible decision makers can use them well. Thanks.
Sure. Yes.
You talk about peer review and you say it's peer reviewed by the public. And my question would be, how do you ensure that you get a correct demographic sample if it's peer-reviewed by the public?
Well, I should have said also that we send the reports out to selected experts as well. For a typical report that we do for a federal agency, that might be 12 to 20 experts plus all the major specialty societies that that care about that issue. These reports, it's a smaller group. It's 4 to 5 usually. So we make sure that some experts, let's say it's a cardiology-related drug, that there are some cardiologists who review it.
Mm-hmm.
The public review process, though, has been pretty productive. Most of the reviewers are either associated with scientific people associated with different pharmaceutical companies, but a lot of them make very good comments. They're good scientists. And then other independent reviewers do chime in. Usually that public peer review, in other words, brings in some people with real expertise. And so we're pretty happy with it as a contributor, but we wouldn't rely on it alone.
Okay, I guess I was misunderstanding when you said public. They have to have some standing somewhere or some knowledge base. I mean, it can be some little farmer from Roseburg like me who doesn't know a thing about these and say, well, I don't think I like that. I mean, you see what I'm saying? I mean, that's what I was asking about.
Well, almost all the people from the public who make these comments do have expertise. But I would say this, that, our reports tend to be pretty technical. They're hard for a layperson to read. And it's on the other hand, it's important that people who actually suffer from the disease being studied have a chance to chime in, because they're the ones that say, why are you spending so much time on how fast these things work? I want to know how much I can rely on them over time. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that know what outcomes are important to patients. If we could find a way to have that kind of input in the peer review process, we would. Where that input really comes in, though, is in developing the questions and making sure that the subcommittees that Oregon and other states put together to tell us what questions to answer include people who have suffered from the disease or advocates for them who can articulate what's really important.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and from that perspective, that makes, I guess, the picture that, when you said that, the picture that came into my mind was if some advocacy group or some other group could have the opportunity to weigh in on the findings and tilt the scale, that would certainly be something to be avoided so that it's balanced. That was,
yeah.
That was the thing that popped in.
Okay. Well, peer review means peer review. Public review is separate than peer review, but to me.
I think that's fair, but when these reports are open for public comment in a draft form, a lot of people who comment on them are peers.
And I think that's valid because they're taking the medicine. Right. Now, there are two things that I'd like to know about. What about your COX-2 inhibitor study, which you found out what other people found out 2 years before they did?
Well, one of the things I've learned from doing these reviews of drugs is that very often in the pre-approval process where the FDA is reviewing the evidence and people there are deciding should they approve this drug or not, a lot of evidence comes out in those processes that never makes it into published peer-reviewed journals. So sometimes we have a study published like the original study of Vioxx which was published, I think, in 2000, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And in the New England Journal of Medicine, out there for everybody to see, it said we had an unexpectedly high rate of heart attacks. The FDA looked at that very carefully. Statistical analysts there spent a long time on it. So it wasn't just a one-liner in a journal article. In our review, we just looked at the complete analysis that the FDA did and what a few other people did. We didn't conclude, and no one could conclude then, that Vioxx was the cause of the heart attacks. But we did notice that over several years, 2000 to 2003, Merck, the maker of Vioxx, sponsored several studies with a very legitimate, open view of this, saying, we think it really was not Vioxx's fault. Here's a study that indicates that it was because naproxen, the comparator drug, prevented more heart attacks, not that Vioxx caused them. Now, they probably were wrong, but they certainly weren't covering anything up. This material was out there in the peer-reviewed literature and in the FDA material for all of us to see. All we did is report it. And because COX-2 inhibitors, their only reason for existence, or I should say their main reason for existence, is because they may have less risk of GI bleeding. In other words, safety is their main reason for existence. The question about their cardiac safety, which was raised all that time ago, was important to some decision makers. And the people looking in our report in Oregon said, essentially, well, Vioxx is the only one of these drugs that has a rock-solid proof that it reduces the risk of bleeding compared to the other painkillers, the other non-steroidals, the older ones. But it sure has this specter that maybe it causes heart attacks. And unless we really know the balance, we're not really sure we'd go with it. Now, the FDA could have said that, too. They could have said, we'll approve this, but you got to explore the cardiac issue. And that's the FDA's issue. And Merck could have done things differently. But physicians prescribe these drugs, not Merck, not the FDA. And that information was in the product label for Vioxx years ago. And all we really did was summarize what was known. And I think the point is, a lot of physicians, including myself, we say we're too busy to read every single thing with all the fine print and every article in the literature. But when you bring it all out there and you get a group of physicians and pharmacists and other people on these panels, they actually have some time to weigh all this. And that's what they did. We didn't discover anything that wasn't out there for everyone to see, but we brought it all in one place, and the state of Oregon brought together people who actually spent some time looking at it.
Very good. Now, my next question has to do with a drug on the market, which is medical marijuana. And we have a bill, actually two bills. One of them is a result of an interim task force that Dr. Grant Higginson put together during the interim from Public Health, and I have been asked by some of the people who are involved if there could be a study done. And I'm asking the question, is there evidence out there that shows the effectiveness of the medical marijuana, the THC, and I understand it comes in pill form, I understand it comes in various forms, and I understand that some of them are more effective than others, some ways of ingesting and so on, but is that an issue that you have ever looked at? Has anyone ever asked you to compile the evidence of the effectiveness of medical marijuana?
We haven't been asked to do that.
Oh, well, I'm asking you, would you please do that?
You know, one thing we don't like, I should say, that when we are asked to do something like that, and there's funding and all.
Funding!
Before we go and spend the money, we do look to see if someone else has done it,
yeah,
according to the standards that we use. And it may well be there is somebody else, you know, who has done a good systematic review of that question, and then we wouldn't repeat it. We'd just bring it to your attention. But no, we haven't been asked to do that.
It is interesting because this is an issue that we will deal with in the legislature, in this committee. There is a actually, there is a fund that has been growing as a result of the cards that were $150, I believe, and they lowered the price significantly because there's money building up that is in a fund. I don't know what it's untapped so far, but I'm seriously looking at whether or not we could do a gathering of information, and I understand there has been research done around the world. I don't know, you know, how much has been done in the United States or in Oregon before, but it would be useful to know. I know the federal government is concerned about that as a narcotic or as a illegal drug, and and so I think it would be interesting, and I guess I need to talk with you separately from this forum about the possibilities of you doing it or pointing me in a direction, because I think it would be useful.
Well, if I could just say one more thing, if it doesn't sound too much like an advertisement. One of the APC investigators, Roger Chow, is under contract with the Pain Society. Nationally. Essentially, 80% of his time will be spent looking at different issues in pain. So it's the kind of thing that would be in his area of expertise within our EPC.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you. Further questions?
Chair Morissette and members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Dr. Kathleen Weaver. I'm the director for the Health Resources Commission. The Health Resources Commission was created as a component of the Oregon Health Plan to achieve its goal of assuring all Oregonians access to high-quality, effective health care at an affordable cost, whether that care is purchased by the state or by the private sector. That was the initial charge. Following the 72nd Legislative Assembly's passage of Senate Bill 819, the Practitioner Managed Prescription Drug Plan, otherwise known as the Preferred Drug List or the Plan Drug List for Oregon Health Plan, specifically directed the Health Resource Commission to advise the Department of Human Services on the preferred drugs within a chosen drug category. As you heard from Dr. Helfand, the Evidence-Based Practice Center produces a report that represents a systematic review of the comparative efficacy and safety of a class of drugs. The subcommittee that we have then evaluates the evidence in this Evidence-Based Practice Center report to determine within the drugs being reviewed whether there's a superior drug for effectiveness or safety. And if the current evidence does not distinguish a difference amongst the drugs, then it is thus stated. And as we'll go on and talk about, and I've given you here some examples of the pages from our website, there in 12 of the 13 cases is no difference in the drugs that were compared. Also, if a drug is not as effective or safe, that is noted, so some drop off the bottom of the list. The subcommittee comes to consensus based on the clinical evaluation of each of those key questions that Dr. Helfand talked about, and then derives a conclusion that is a summary statement of the major decisions of the committee. It is designed to be easily interpreted by the Oregon Department of Human Services for determining what we call the benchmark drug. The subcommittee report is submitted for approval to our full Health Resource Commission at a public meeting, and there's opportunity for people to testify both at our subcommittee meetings and at the full Health Resource Commission. And sometimes the industry does, or as you were asking about, the advocates. So there's several opportunities for their input to occur. They also can be present at the time that the key questions are developed. And really, the key questions are key, because if you don't ask the right questions, you don't get the right answers. And so developing those questions and modifying them as we go along, if need be, with new information is really important. Our website, which is under Oregon.gov or OregonRx.org, lists three different levels of report. There are these one-pagers that I gave you. There's about a 20-page report, which is the full subcommittee report, and then the evidence-based practice center report may be up to 200 pages. So there's, you can drill down and get more and more information if you want, but there's one based for patients, one based for the doctors, and then those for the real scientists that want to look at those. Over the past 2 years, the Health Resources Commission has approved 13 of these evidence-based reports, and there's an example there. We've also done 15 updates, and so every year at least we update these reports because there's new drugs, new information. Was the case that you mentioned with the COX-2 inhibitors, sometimes a drug is taken off the market and we need to respond to that. Incidentally, we were proud by the fact that although we were criticized at the time for not including the COX-2 inhibitors, we did feel that the evidence was such and was presented to us in such a great form that we could make that kind of decision. And so it wasn't that there was any new evidence. It was the matter of distilling it down so that we could, I think, make the appropriate decision. The subcommittees, of which there are 20, involve 150 volunteers, and I think that's important because they become ambassadors for our program. These are physicians, nurse practitioner, nurses, physician assistants, pharmacists, and consumers or consumer advocates. Each subcommittee has multiple meetings to develop their clinical report in response to the evidence-based practice center drug class review. The handouts I gave you are summaries from our website, as I said, of the completed classes, including non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, because I understand you don't like to use abbreviations, but that's otherwise known as NSAIDs, proton pump inhibitors, statins that are used to lower cholesterol, diabetes drugs, urinary incontinence drugs, muscle relaxants, and four classes of blood pressure medication. Medication to relieve migraine, estrogen replacement drugs, and as was mentioned, we have done one on long-acting pain relievers, not marijuana, but some of the opioid long-acting pain relievers. In addition to those 13 reports, this year we will be focusing on five new ones, including inhaled corticosteroids for asthma, anti-nausea drugs, drugs for rheumatoid arthritis, antiplatelet drugs to prevent strokes and heart attacks. Our evidence-based reports are valuable, I feel, to all Oregonians, whether they pay cash for their drugs, because they have the highest price to pay of all, and that information is helpful, whether they have tiered copays, which are based on price, or whether they're paying taxes for the Oregon Health Plan patients. Knowing the most effective and least costly drugs can assist policymakers to make empowered decisions. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before your committee, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions.
do insurance companies in Oregon use your list?
That's a good question. We recently have been doing a survey at finding out whether they do or not. It's a little more difficult with the insurance companies because they have a separate rebate process, and they may use the information, but we don't know that. It's available for everybody. We do know that AARP uses this and has a direct link to our website, and that nationally Consumer Reports uses this. So I think the transparency of this is really important. We put it out there for anybody to use.
Okay, I'm trying to think of how, now theoretically the consumer would also be looking at your website. And
they can, and AARP has a
separate. AARP, and I'm trying to think of how this would filter back to the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies of these are the kinds of recommended drugs that we want and they're not on your list. How come we can't get
right.
something like that?
If I can bring it up, in states where there's a more strict process where there's prior approval, then what happens is that there's competition, of course, to be on the preferred drug list, and that creates what they call secondary or supplemental rebates.
Okay.
So that's one of the processes where it can get back. Does that answer your question?
Well, yeah, and I think that I'm not sure where we're going in Oregon with our bulk purchasing program and so on, but I think that you know, the kind of information you have is important to us.
Right. You can combine knowing the cost effectiveness, and then if you have a number of people with the bulk purchasing, that gives you real leverage then to encourage that there be competition.
Yeah.
if the drugs are the same.
We have an infancy, we're in an infancy stage in a program, and we do have a director and we have a PBM who is in the purchasing.
Right.
And we have people signing up for the program.
Right. And I work with Missy Dolan, and it's really exciting because the calls and the faxes are coming in like crazy. So
well,
I think
that's really the reason that
news.
I invited you here is to kind of understand, you know,
right,
how we're progressing and the role that you guys are playing. So
I know that they, in that particular program, have a P&T committee.
Uh-huh.
And they don't exclusively use our information, but they started out with looking at the drugs that we have studied and use that information to help them make decisions and combine that with other information. So we certainly do work together, but we're a separate program.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes.
Oops.
How many additional classes are under review right now?
There are five right now that are under review. And we may be adding to that. We have another meeting of what's called the governance group of the states that are combined, the requestees, and that's in May, and so there may be some more that will be coming in the next round.
Okay. Paul.
Yes.
Let's say you decide to review a class, and you came to the conclusion that you didn't have sufficient data sets. What would you do?
If you didn't have sufficient data
sets, what would you do?
If you do not have sufficient evidence to decide if one drug is superior, but they have been approved for use by the FDA, then cost can become a consideration for those drugs. In other words, you could say that they are equal. The FDA only requires to get licensed that the studies show that they're better than placebo. The studies that we accept have set a higher standard than that. And preferably, we like head-to-head studies, but you can't always get those. So sometimes there's not the evidence for that. And so there are times, like Dr. Helfand said, where there's gaps in the evidence. But we can at least say that they're equal. We can't say that one's better than the other in that case.
Are you envisioning, or are you, or anytime soon, moving into psychotropics, or does that get too convoluted for you?
Well, I don't think it gets too convoluted. It is an area, I think, that needs to be looked at carefully. The Evidence-Based Practice Center and two of their subsidiaries that they have, there's two other evidence-based practice centers, have actually done reports on some of the psychotropic drugs. But by law, by Senate Bill 819, we've not looked at those.
Right.
I have looked at those, and they're done in ever as much detail. And a lot of thought goes into how this is done, a lot of testimony. But they've looked at antidepressant drugs, antipsychotic or atypical mm-hmm. antipsychotics, some of the anti-seizure medicines that are used for mental health purposes. And it is important that, like I say, that you have all the testimony and the groups concerned. But I think it's important to know more about drugs, not less. And it doesn't mean that any of these drugs are going to be eliminated, but it helps for practitioners to have this evidence distilled down to the point where you can use that effectively.
I guess part of it. I mean, you know, you know, COX-2 is kind of direct cause and effect sort of thing. You know, I guess when you get into maybe even to a degree, and to some diabetes protocols, you know, the ability of the person to desire to continue, you know, with their therapy is as much a key as whether the drug's effective or not. You can have a very effective antidepressant drug, and if the person just doesn't like the way they are on it, they quit doing it, and so it doesn't matter how effective it is, it's not working, sort of thing. So I guess the reason was, it's kind of apples and oranges to a degree. So I was wondering how you factor in more subjective things like that.
Right. Well, I think it's important to know that these drugs are often compared to placebo. And amazingly, placebos can be very effective, not only in mental health, but in other diseases. Even placebo surgeries, such as arthroscopies, have shown to have, you know, a 30 to 40% because the doctor wants them to get well, the patient wants to get well, this sort of thing. I would agree that it is important to look at this, though, in areas where you don't have the hard numbers. But I think in psychiatry that they're coming up with better and better ways to measure this kind of thing and to look at outcomes and to look at what we call effectiveness, which is how it works in the real world, not just efficacy.
Yeah, I mean the point, Ms. Chair, is quite simply you can have drug A and drug B and they can have an equal effect on treating exactly what it is they're supposed to treat. But if you have a whole list of side effects on drug A that actually in some ways make the patient feel worse, and drug B doesn't, you know, there's got to be some preferential consideration giving to that, not just point of contact, but, you know, kind of the whole disease management concept. But what you're talking about is long-term outcomes, and
well, I think it's
in the interest of mine.
Right, it's really important, and we would like to see studies in which both effectiveness and safety are measured in the same study. Because then often if you're comparing drug A to drug B, they'll have comparable doses, and you can get a better outcome. And that's ideally. One of the things we do, though, is we feedback. In our reports, we say where the evidence is lacking, and then we try and get that information back to say, you know, these are the studies we'd like to see. And the industry has been very good about responding to saying, you know, well, we'd like to do this, or, you know, it's very expensive for them to do studies. But if we can help direct that and get the information we want, we think that's good.
So yeah, well, we're going to move on. Okay, I could go on for a while.
I know, that's why we're going to move on. So if somebody has a heart attack taking a COX-2 inhibitor, you know that there's a side effect that isn't desirable, right?
Well, the problem is, do you want me to answer that?
No. Okay. No, I don't want the answer.
No.
Now, we're going to change the order because we have some guests who came from long distances, and I want to be sure. Did you come from a long distance?
You came from David. His presentation's on his computer. Can you go through your power?
Oh, yes. Yeah, go ahead. You go. You're I'm sorry. Then. Okay,
I'm just David, the AV guy here.
That, we are going to change in the order after you. Good. Thank you. Yeah.
I did.
Ready for me to start?
Yeah.
Shall I speak?
Yes, please, please.
Members of the Chairman Morrison, members of the committee, my name is David Pollack. I'm a psychiatrist. I'm the medical director for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I'm a professor of psychiatry and public health and preventive medicine and family medicine at OHSU. And I've been asked to come today to talk about the mental health medication initiatives that we've been doing here at the Department of Human Services. This is a good segue from the last set of questions. And actually, if we have time for questions, I could respond to some of those issues that Dr. Weaver was addressing as well. A couple factoids for you. Of the medications that are for mental health conditions, the top 10 in terms of the amount of money that the Medicaid office spends on them equal about 36% of the total amount of Medicaid drug budget for fee-for-service drugs. And it's for all the mental health medications, they represent right at half of the Medicaid expenditures for fee-for-service medications. Kathy Ketchum, who will be on a little later, will give you some additional data that will explain this a little further. But just to put these things into perspective, if you look at the total that is spent, $820 million in a two-year period on medications through the Office Medical Assistance Programs, the mental health medications represent about 31% of the total medication budget. So it's a big chunk. It's a disproportionate chunk in some ways in relation to what all the other drugs represent as well. And there are reasons for that. One is that these medications, because of legislation that was passed two sessions ago, are not allowed to be limited in terms of prior authorization or preferred drug list. So in view of that, our office and the Medicaid office have been working on a set of initiatives that would, in a sense, achieve what we consider a holy trinity here: maintaining access to medications and open access to as many of those medications as possible, increasing the quality of mental health prescribing practices, and containing the high cost of prescription medications if at all possible. Now, the second bullet there is a really important one, because in the process of looking at how can we address the cost concerns, especially when we don't have the opportunity to limit the medications in the way certain other classes of medications can be limited, we've looked at what the prescribing practices are, and there's quite a bit of variation amongst prescribing providers. Part of this relates to the fact that people who receive medications for mental health conditions are seen by all kinds of providers. Over 70% of the antidepressant medications are prescribed by primary care providers and other non-mental health specialists. Over half of the antipsychotic drugs are prescribed by non-psychiatrists. So, we have some principles that we use to guide our decision making. One was to use management actions that would be voluntary in nature and would result in the least disruption to our service system, that would emphasize quality improvement approaches, such as reducing polypharmacy and prescribing patterns that are outside generally accepted standards. Here we use some of the evidence-based data that we've gotten from various studies that say this particular practice, using two medications of the same class, generally does not add to the benefit for a patient in some of these conditions. We know that prior authorization, preferred drug lists are not available to us as an option, but if these measures that we're using do not work, such measures may be required in the future. We don't know. However, we think that there's some strategies that we can use, and we've been trying to use, to increase accountability and to more specifically address these prescribing practices. First of all, we're using pharmaceutical utilization data, the claims data that we get from the pharmacies on Medicaid prescriptions, that tell us something about the prescribing patterns of these providers throughout our system. That helps us to identify those providers who seem to be practicing in some ways that could benefit from some feedback, and we want to provide them consultation and support. We also think that we can improve our data. We found a number of some problems in our data system, including the fact that a number of claims have no ability to identify who the prescribing provider was, and we have a system by which we're going to fix that over the next few months. We're very confident in that. We're also using this data to provide feedback to prescribing providers in the form of here's your profile, and I'll show you a little bit of an example of that a little later. We want to encourage quality improvement initiatives. More generally, some of these have to do with increasing the use of consultation from experts around the state and expanding the use of disease state management concepts, such as one that's known as the chronic care model or the care model that's been used both in the treatment of depression in primary care. Yes, Senator.
We have a bill that we're going to be hearing soon about electronic tracking of certain kinds of drugs. I don't know if it would include this category. I don't think so. It might. No. Now, are you doing... Now, I could you go through this again?
I'm sorry if I went too fast.
Well, it just caught my attention because we have a bill. In fact, it's going to be coming up on Thursday, I believe, and it is an attempt to make sure that people are not going from pharmacy to pharmacy to pharmacy.
This is Senate Bill 180, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That bill is addressing controlled substances.
Controlled substances.
And it's addressing the concern about some patients, in a sense, doctor shopping, and possibly using those drugs for purposes that are unrelated to their therapeutic benefit, but more for their recreational or addictive potential.
Okay.
And it's an attempt to improve the database resource. In a sense, we have a number of potential uses for electronic data that we get from pharmacies. That is one. What we're doing here is slightly different, but it's using the same kind of mechanism.
Yeah, well, I said I was getting it as a mechanism. So
yes.
Okay.
Shall I go on?
Yeah.
Thank you. Then we have the medication-specific strategies, and now we get into the meat of what I was going to present. We can focus both on quality and cost-effectiveness in how we intervene here. So we've developed three separate initiatives that we are implementing, the first two of which we've already started. The third one we are in the process of beginning. The Behavioral Pharmacy Management System, Value Enhancement Initiative, and the Medication Management Algorithm Project, better known as MedMap. First on BPMS, the first one. It's a quality improvement collaboration with a company called Comprehensive Neuroscience that is, in effect, a mental health medication-focused organization that does technical assistance and takes our Medicaid claims data and some other data that we provide to them. They crunch the data, and they determine, based on our own decisions about some indicators, which kinds of practices we want to give people feedback about, which prescribing providers to send information to. We send this in the form of letters that give them a list of their patients for whom this particular practice is a concern, with some educational materials and suggesting to them that there may be a preferred alternative to what they've been doing. These are some examples. Yes, Senator Cruz.
What would be a concern? I mean, when you're talking about a prescribing practice, so you will say you should be giving them drug X rather than drug Y, that sort of thing, or...
Chairman Morissette and Senator Cruz, not exactly. This next slide gives you some examples of what we're trying to get at, but don't say you should prescribe this drug or that drug, but say a practice that includes two drugs of the same class, for example, two or more concurrent atypical antipsychotics, which is the first one, or duplicate therapy within the same drug class of other classes, such as some of the newer antidepressants or mood stabilizer medications, doesn't make sense. There's no data really to support that being effective. It doesn't say which one to prescribe. It says we suggest that it may be wise to consider discontinuing one of those two drugs because there's really not much evidence to support that. Going over the highest level of dose that the FDA approves of antipsychotic medications is another concern that we share about. Others have to do with being on too many of any kind of psychiatric medication, three or more in children under 18, five or more in adults. We also have the last two bullets in this list are not so much these are bad prescribing practices or prescribing practices that we are concerned about. And in all of these cases, we're not saying these folks are doing bad. We're saying there's evidence that shows that these things don't generally work. However, we recognize that there are exceptions to all of these practices, and people have learned with some very complex patients that they must use two drugs of one class, or they must use a higher dose in some cases. The last two bullets, however, are very useful feedback for prescribing providers, which again we can get from the claims data. We can tell a prescribing provider, did you know that there's another prescribing provider prescribing the same medication or a medication from the same class of drugs for this patient? And that is very useful. They can call that other prescribing provider, or they can call the patient or talk to the patient and say, what's going on? Let's try to figure this out. We probably shouldn't both be prescribing this medication. And the last bullet is on patients who are on antipsychotic medications, the most serious medications we use, when those patients have stopped the medication apparently prematurely, which is often associated with them not doing as well and ending up in the hospital, we want to provide that feedback to the prescribing provider in case he or she didn't know that the patient. It may have been a planned discontinuation of that medication, but if it wasn't, then they should know it, and they will then be able to talk to the patient, see whether or not they had just stopped it by accident or intended to, or whether they can negotiate whether it makes sense to start it up again.
We know, for example, that especially in our Medicaid population, a very small number of people use an inordinately large amount of our drug budget, you know, that have 10, 15 prescriptions. Is this going to help us get a handle on that in any way?
Yes, we think it will. We're already seeing some evidence that it is. We won't have more definitive evidence for another 2 or 3 months, but we're very encouraged.
Okay.
This will give you an example of the people who were targeted. And what this process with BPMS is we target the 400 highest volume prescribing providers in the state. In a sense, they're the low-hanging fruit, and we're getting more bang for our buck by attending to them, and we can expand beyond. Of those that we sent letters out during the first 7-8 months of this project, you can see the number of persons for whom multiple atypical antipsychotic prescriptions were going went down. So it went down from about 800, a little over 800 patients down to about a little over 400 patients, although that's a sample of the total universe of patients we have. We have about, I'll show you in a slide later on how many people we have on any antipsychotic in the state. So this represents only less than 2 or 3% of the patients who are on any antipsychotic. Which is good, but there are not that many who are receiving multiple ones. Mm-hmm. And this is these next slides to show you the examples of the way we can show the data to people, and we can aggregate it and look in general on how we're doing. This last one showing that it's a relatively flat line, but it's a very small number, only 200 to 250 people who have prematurely stopped their antipsychotic medications. The second initiative is one we call value enhancement. The main feature of this is giving feedback, again based on pharmaceutical claims data, to prescribing providers about what we call dose optimization, meaning that either by consolidating the dose of a medication or giving a larger pill and splitting the pill, we can save money. We only do this in a voluntary setting where patients and the providers say, yes, this makes sense. We're only doing it on certain medications right now, certain antidepressant medications, and we're coupling it with these other two bullets, giving feedback more generally to prescribing providers about their practice patterns and educating them about the cost of medications. The medications we're using in this first go-round on the dose optimization are these antidepressants that are listed in the first sub-bullet there. We, in October, sent out about almost 1,600 faxes to prescribing providers around the state, in other words, affecting 1,582 patients who were receiving one or another of these antidepressants, for whom either taking one pill at one time a day, and all of these medications are ones where 24-hour half-life of the medication operates, so once a day dosing is fine. And so if the person's on, for example, 2 25-milligram pills of Zoloft, for example, and they were taking 1 25-milligram in the morning, one in the evening, if you could consolidate that to a 50-milligram pill and take it once a day, you would save half the cost of that medication, because these are medications in which the pricing is relatively flat, meaning a 25, a 50, and 100-milligram pill of that particular medication is roughly the same cost per pill. Mm-hmm. You could give that same patient a 100-milligram pill of Zoloft and cut it in half, and take half a pill a day, you would save three-quarters of the cost of the original 225-milligram medication pills. So it seems to us relatively straightforward that this would be a wise thing to do. And if the patient was capable of handling this, and the patient and the prescribing provider thought it was a good idea, they should do it. Well, of the 1,582 faxes we sent out, over 950 were returned. And said that, yes, we'll accept this change. There were a few that were returned and didn't accept the change. But of those that didn't accept the change, which was really a small number, only 162, most of them were prescribers who said, this isn't my patient. It has to do with the data problem that we've got that we're trying to fix. But of those 956 who said, yes, I'll change it, and which gives us the authority to contact the pharmacy and make the change, we're able to close that loop. We were able to, in effect, obtain cost avoidance of about $30,000 a month, or around $360,000. If we do this once a quarter and we continue sending out these faxes on a regular basis, we think that can actually be a much larger number over time. These are some slides that show you an example of how we can show for a group practice, this is the state, or an individual, how many patients he or she has on a certain class of medications, how many are the practice pattern is showing a problem or a potential problem in terms of duplicate therapy. It's obvious that the state does not have a problem right now with duplicate therapy of antidepressants. There's very little of that going on. The real concern we have is the third line, the 0.3% of duplicate SSRIs. There's not much evidence to support that, but there's also very little evidence that it's happening here in the state. So we're pleased with that. There is some evidence that there's duplicate atypical antipsychotic prescribing going on, and you see that we have about 40,000 patients in the Medicaid system on any antipsychotic medication, and just under 5% of them are getting two atypicals. So those are the prescribing providers who treat those patients that we'll be sending those letters to. Similarly, duplicate therapy with mood stabilizer medications. These are medications for bipolar disorder, or what we've called manic depressive illness in the past. Here's an example of just getting a sense of how many people are on multiple psychiatric medications. Here we did a study looking at how many were on four or more. That's not quite 10% of the 90,000 people who are on any psychiatric medication. That's a very large number. And so we're concerned about that. We've also discovered, this is not in your slides, that we have a small number of children who are under 5 years of age who are on some of these powerful antidepressant, antipsychotic medications. We've become concerned enough that we're going to send letters out to all the prescribing providers who have patients who are under five with those medications saying, gee, we're not sure why this is happening. There are certain limited cases where this may be appropriate, but we don't think the numbers we're seeing merit it. And we're also educating prescribing providers about costs. The principles of this are that we want them to understand that we're trying to promote positive clinical outcomes for all of the patients, but at the same time that we want to remain mindful of the relative costs, including the overall cost of care, not just the cost of the medication, but if you're just focusing on the cost of medication, hospitalizations figure into this. And if you're cutting costs by not giving the right medication because it costs less, and you end up with more people in the hospital, you're losing money in the long run. We identify and we ask the prescribers to identify drugs within a class that have the therapeutic equivalence and effectiveness. Some of this is derived from the studies that Dr. Helfain and others are doing. And then we would ask the prescribing provider to consider eliminating the drugs that don't make sense because of side effects, as you were concerned about, Senator Cruz, and prior history, family history, comorbidities, other illnesses that might prevent them being able to take one or another medication. And then if two or more medications remain in the array of choice that the prescribing provider could consider, we think then the acquisition cost for that medication makes sense. There is a booklet that the Medicaid office puts out with the School of Pharmacy that is, in a sense, the pocket hand guide or pocket guide to the prescription drug costs, giving a relative cost of all the medications that are used in the Medicaid system and the roughly average cost of a month's prescription of those medications. Last couple slides. The algorithm project that we're doing is, instead of a retrospective data review-based approach that these first two initiatives are, this is one that's a practice guideline approach. It's an evidence-based practice, as a matter of fact, that the federal government has said this is a practice that achieves the threshold of evidence-based status. And what it does is there are three practice guidelines in the form of algorithms or kind of staged decision-making process that a prescribing provider would follow in a rational way when he or she was considering treating someone with medications for any of three major conditions: psychotic disorders, bipolar disorder, and depression. And this would be an approach to help them make their decisions in what medications to, or not what medications to prescribe, but how long to prescribe a medication before adjusting and then changing to another medication or adding a medication. But the project includes two other features that are very important. One is getting the prescribing providers who do this to agree to a standard progress note format. It would include the pertinent information, including outcomes measures that they would record when they see the patient on a periodic basis, that we would then get that data and be able to follow how well they're doing, and they would be able to follow the patient's progress as well. The third piece is something called a peer education or patient education curriculum, where patients who have these kinds of illnesses have worked with others to develop a curriculum to train other patients about what their illnesses are about, what their medications are about, and how to be more active and effective participants in their own care. We think it's very important, and many people say that having an active and educated patient makes much better sense and leads to more people participating in their care and adhering to treatment. One of the things that Senator Cruz was concerned about before was you can have this medication and that medication are both effective, but if the person stops taking them, there's no effect. There's a whole body of literature on this issue of adherence to treatment. How can we promote people staying on their medications if that's appropriate, or staying with the treatment? And a lot of that involves having a good relationship between the prescribing provider and the other members of the treatment team and the patient, and for the patient to have as much decision-making capability in the process as seems appropriate.
Now, could you take just a minute to tell me who the scope of providing the provider is, prescribing provider?
Which prescribing providers
we
have?
Are we talking your family practitioner?
In the first two initiatives, we're sending information out to anyone who's prescribing those medications, so it does include the family practitioners and others. For this algorithm project, we're focusing primarily on the psychiatric prescribing providers, because both in the hospital setting and in the outpatient mental health clinics, because the patients who have those illnesses tend to get started on them either in the hospital or in the mental health clinic. They may end up migrating to or gravitating to the primary care provider later on.
You're and talking about a psychiatrist.
Yes, we're talking about psychiatrists and psychiatric nurse practitioners for the most part.
Now, we had a hearing in a different committee last week, and this was actually about whether or not psychologists should prescribe, and the whole time was spent by the psychiatrist talking about all of the prescriptions, and they weren't really talking about psychologists. They were talking about doctors who were not writing the right prescriptions. The psychologists can't do that. And it was an interesting discussion, because what I got out of it is there are a lot of doctors out there who don't know what they're doing.
Senator Moore said, I actually listened to that hearing.
Oh.
And I was very impressed with the discussion. And I agree. We have concerns about the folks who have the prescribing capability now, and we think getting the right education to them is extremely important. And there are other aspects of what we're doing as a department that are addressing that as well. In particular, we have an initiative that is trying to address the integration of mental health and primary care, and trying to provide the appropriate co-location of behavioral health providers, including prescribing expertise from psychiatrists and psychiatric nurse practitioners, to those primary care clinics, both in the communities in the urban area as well as in the rural and frontier areas. The second thing we're doing is improving and really expanding what we can do in terms of telehealth and getting psychiatric expertise out to the areas that have less access to psychiatric prescribers.
Now, one of the alternatives that I thought of was to require continuing education for prescribing it, but that raises another issue in terms of we don't want to do that. But what you're talking about,
what?
Okay, what you're talking about makes a lot of sense, and I was not aware that you were doing this kind of contact work, but you're obviously not reaching everybody. Is there a way that you're reaching a good percentage of people? You get a response, but it should it bothers me a little bit that there are people who have the ability to write prescriptions that they probably shouldn't be writing because they don't have the education.
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, I'll not go too far off script here, but I think this is very connected. The issues around how we help support primary care providers is extremely important, and I think what we're doing in another context, and I'd be glad to come back and talk more about that initiative, is important. We're focusing in particular on the safety net clinics, the federally qualified health centers, and rural health clinics, and community health clinics as a first step. And there are actually several pilot projects around the state that are going on that we're addressing. We have a core working group from around the state that we actually have our next meeting tomorrow afternoon to try to address this issue and promote better interaction between them. The last point I want to make here, if I could, and then if there are other questions about this, are that we have an implementation process for this medication algorithm project that we're going to start by getting some pilot sites. We hope to get about 3 sites that will be a combination of an acute psychiatric impact program and the county mental health program from 1 or 2 counties that work closest with that hospital, and train those psychiatric staff in both places and get the other staff who work with those patients to participate in the practice guideline that we'll be trying to implement and develop the peer education project in those 3 sites as well. And then we think it will be rather quick that it will spread to the rest of the state, because this project has been done in other parts of the country. Started in Texas, it's been in Ohio and Pennsylvania, it's in San Diego County and some other places, and it's seen very good results with it. So that's the end of my prepared comments.
Now, I'd like to speak before I have questions. We're only going to have one more informational hearing today, and that is the Medicaid 340B, because we don't have time to do justice to all of the others and we overbooked. And I would just ask, I just want to, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, Jim, we just don't have the time, and it would be, if you could come back, that would be great. And Kathy, where's Kathy? Kathy, okay. So I'd like to, we're going to have about 45 minutes to do that last presentation, and you travel from, where are you?
Over there.
Oh, okay. You travel from long distances, and we want to hear your, now, let's finish this. Uh-huh. Yes, Jeff.
Thank you. You almost spoke too long, I forgot my train of thought, but I have short memory problems. There's a drug for it, I'm sure. You know, when I was getting back, Senator Morissette, you and I have been talking about electronic prescription writing for many, many, many years as something we ought to be going through. And I was going back into this, into your education about costs, and wondering, number one, quite how you do it, you know, but if we got into the electronic prescription writing, I didn't want to talk about side. I mean, a part of this is just making prescribers aware of things. And you know, if we had electronic prescription writing, clearly there could be pop-up menus inside of that system that would show all these things, because when you get to your, when you get to your pocket book, which would be outdated as soon as it's printed, more or less, you know, that we'd have the flexibility to continually update that sort of thing. So, you know, we keep finding more evidence, Senator, of the fact that we've been right all these years.
And the world is wrong.
And the experts have been wrong. So, I would be interested in finding out if the way you're going about it and the way we would like to go about it, which would be a more cost-effective way, and which would disseminate the information better.
Well, Chairman Morissette and Senator Cruz, I think that a lot of the world of healthcare delivery is going to electronic medical records, electronic mechanisms of communicating and managing information. It's just that some systems can't afford the startup costs. We're going to see more of it happening, though, as we go. OHSU right now is implementing a large-scale electronic medical record system that will probably have some of those capabilities that you're describing. the new Medicare Modernization Act, it has with it some proposals for electronic prescribing. We will see how that evolves. We're also, at the same time, talking about systems that are terribly under-resourced, that have gone through tremendous cuts in the last few years, so it's hard to imagine that they're going to be able to have the capability to do this kind of prescribing unless something happens to restore some of the funding for them or to deal with their infrastructure difficulties.
Well, Mr. Chair, and most doctors that I visited have computers, and we're talking about purchase of a piece of software, which I don't think would be that restrictive. And you know, I mean, I just look at all the changes that are happening in the system, and you know, HIPAA's changed the world, and it seems to me this is the absolutely golden opportunity to move there, and there may be a few doctors in the world that don't have computers, but they're probably about to retire anyway. So, you know, I think it warrants a hard look, Mr. Chair. And I think we ought to do some exploration.
Senator Morissette and Senator Cruz, there are lots of resources. My little Palm Pilot, I have something called Hippocrates on it, so I can look up any medication on it. So there are a lot of resources available to us. Having them available in a way that one can aggregate the data and use it in the ways we're talking about requires more of a system. But we should take whatever we can get in terms of advancing our knowledge and our capability. I agree with you.
Well, some closed health systems already have the technology in place, so it's not like we have to reinvent something. We just have to figure a way to disseminate it. So
absolutely. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Would you like to come up, please? Okay.
When we have a good idea, we should continue pursuing it.
Welcome. And you came a long way, right?
Where did I come? Phoenix.
It's raining in Phoenix. I just got the weather report.
I came here for the lovely weather.
No, it's 90 degrees in Phoenix, I think.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Senator Morissette, Chairman, and members of the committee. I am Shauna Kittredge. I'm with Mercer Government Human Services Consulting. This is Stephanie Davis. We are here, been requested to speak to you regarding 340B.
Mm-hmm.
Security and other assorted things. As introductions, I'm a consultant with Mercer. I'm also a licensed pharmacist and have been for many years. And prior to coming to work for Mercer, I was the Medicaid Pharmacy Director for the state of Idaho, Department of Health and Welfare. So the presentation will be a bit of an overview of the 340B program, what is going on currently in other states, and what possible opportunities there may be for the state of Oregon.
Okay.
The 340B program, the legislation enacted to provide indigent populations greater access to medications by offering steep discounts for drugs to what are considered, or what are called, covered entities that serve these populations. You may have also heard it.
Okay. I think somebody hit the wrong switch.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The lights go off.
Well, that was a quick presentation.
Well, I'll say welcome again.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
The 340B program has also been called the PHS Pricing Program, 340B Pricing, or the Veterans Health Care Act Program. Section 340B was enacted in 1992, and it's part of the Veterans Health Care Act. It was actually enacted in response to increase in prices that were found following the 1990 OBRA laws establishing Medicaid best price. Because the Medicaid best price, at that time, it discouraged manufacturers from entering into agreements with these safety net entities because it was considered as part of the best price and affected their pricing, the overall lowest pricing available. With this legislation, the 340B price is excluded from the Medicaid best price. The manufacturers participating in Medicaid are also required at the time to sign up for the 340B agreement. So essentially, it requires the manufacturers to provide the drugs to the covered entities at the reduced prices without penalty. The covered entities that you hear of with a 340B program are the nation's truly core medical safety net providers. Currently, there's over 11,000 of them, of these certified covered entities in the nation, and I believe in Oregon, with the research that I found, there were 188 of them currently. They are federal grant recipients and disproportionate share hospitals. And the grant recipients include the federally qualified health centers, or the FQHCs, and examples of those are listed there, the migrant health centers, et cetera, and actually also family planning clinics, TB clinics, HIV clinics, and numerous others that you'll see listed here as well. Hemophilia clinics, black lung treatment clinics, STD clinics, and the two non-grantee covered entities are the bottom two, the FQHC lookalikes, and then the DSH hospitals, or disproportionate share hospitals. There's many definitions and acronyms throughout the 340B program, as there are with several of the federal programs. Covered outpatient drugs under this program are both prescription and non-prescription drugs that are obtained through a written prescription. It does exclude explicitly vaccines and inpatient drugs. And there is a clear definition around who a patient can be of a covered entity. The patient must receive a range of healthcare services from a practitioner from a 340B entity, and the health record must be maintained by the entity. So only going and have a prescriptions filled from that entity does not qualify you as a covered patient.
You want to ask that question?
Well, yes, maybe when you get down to down to the ceiling price, how the AWP price of 51% compares to our current Medicaid price for OHP.
Okay. Should
I compare?
Okay. And then a ceiling price. This is the highest price that the covered entity will pay for that drug. And some entities can pay less than the ceiling price through negotiated contracts. And the average 340B discount is 51% below what you'll hear called AWP, or the average wholesale price. Now, typical Medicaids run anywhere from AWP, net. This is net of rebates, AWP minus 32 to AWP minus 39%. If that gives you some idea of where that falls. There are certain requirements that a 340B program must fulfill.
So we get 39.
And the first is what is called, there's to be no double dipping, and that's double dipping of rebates. So drugs purchased through the 340B program are not to be subject to both a 340B discount up front and then a Medicaid rebate on the back end for Medicaid recipients. The covered entities must bill Medicaid at acquisition cost plus a state allowable dispensing fee. And then the state cannot request a rebate from the manufacturer on those products. Now, covered entities within a state, they can exercise their option to carve out Medicaid drugs purchased from the 340B program. And in this way, state would lose those savings. And some entities, covered entities, have done that carve-out or have exercised that option to carve-out because they are required to bill at their true acquisition cost or their actual acquisition cost plus a dispensing fee. So any profit margin they are not allowed to keep that profit. Now, some states have agreed to pay the covered entities a reasonable markup above their acquisition cost or an enhanced dispensing fee to maintain the savings and encourage those entities to be part of the 340B program and not carve out Medicaid. That does require CMS approval.
Now, Maine, Minnesota, Utah?
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts,
Minnesota, okay. And Utah.
Okay. I was thinking Maine has their own, they have a reimportation.
Yeah, I think they do several things around reimportation. Okay. That's Massachusetts. And we'll get into some state-specific examples and specific to Utah and Massachusetts. The other requirement around the 340B program is that the covered entity cannot and shall not resell or transfer the drug to a person who's not a patient of the entity. Now, there are benefits that the covered entities obviously will reap through this program, one being the savings, and reported savings of 25% to 50% for the outpatient drugs over what they would pay through a normal wholesale arrangement. And these savings allow the entities to improve their healthcare delivery in multiple ways. They can reduce the price of prescriptions for their patients. Essentially, they can pass on those savings directly to their clients. They can use that margin to also expand other services offered by the 340B. They can use that margin to increase the number of patients they serve or expand the drugs on their formulary. And one of the differences between the 340B and, say, and your traditional Medicaid program is that the manufacturer discounts are applied up front. The 340B entities are purchasers, they're not payers, so they get that discount up front on the purchases of the medications. And some of the 340B providers regularly negotiate sub-ceiling prices so that they can go even their rates can go even further than that AWP, minus 50. Now, over the time, the federal government has tried to increase access and essentially promote the use of the 340B program and have made modifications to their program to enhance the entities to become part of the program. In 1996, they made a change where allows a 340B entity to contract with a pharmacy. This is because prior to that, a lot of 340B entities can't sustain an in-house pharmacy themselves. They're either rural, they don't have the patient base, but this allows them to contract with a community pharmacy or another pharmacy contractor. And it also allows what's considered a ship-to-bill-to arrangement, whereas the drug is shipped to the pharmacy, but the cost of the medication from the wholesaler is billed to the 340B entity.
Now, we're still talking about the safety net entities that you're talking
yes.
about. And in Oregon, we have
188
in Oregon that are taking advantage of this program in terms of their drug prices. Is that right?
I would have to verify whether they're all taking advantage of it,
oh.
of the program.
Oh, okay.
In fully, but that's what's reported as 188
are enrolled.
Safety net clinics? They've got to be federally qualified?
Well, no.
Well, they're the federally qualified healthcare right. communities. They're your TB clinics, STD clinics.
Okay.
Yeah,
rural health clinics, and
yeah.
that's part of the loop.
Okay.
They are.
Yeah.
They're federally.
Okay.
The non-federally qualified rural health clinics are not part of
it. It depends on where they fall within the federal government. Has very specific program outlines as far as what qualifies and what does not qualify, because there are some lookalikes. So we could, I could.
So, you know, but we do have that. A list, right?
You were gone.
There is a.
Hmm? Oh, it's coming?
It was.
Well, there's.
There's a list of generalities in the handout.
Right, no, I was looking for a list of clinics.
Yeah, we'll have to.
That is available on the 340B website
okay.
through the federal government, through HHS.
David, could you please get that for us? The list of clinics?
There are people in the public health office who can get it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
In 2001, The program was also modified to allow alternative method demonstration projects, and these projects allow the covered entities to increase their patient access through either allowing more than one contracted pharmacy, so a federally qualified health center could contract with a network of pharmacies versus just contracting with one community pharmacy. It allows the contracted pharmacy services, allowing the use of contracted pharmacy services also to supplement if they already have an in-house pharmacy. So it expands that access. And it also makes it easier for networks of covered entities to participate together. And those are demonstration projects that do have to be signed up for or made application to the federal government. But there is not a time frame or limitation around. There are many opportunities for the states that we'll discuss, and I'll give you some examples of what some states are doing. But overall, where states have gone to increase their or maximize the use of the 340B program is through increasing the enrollment of the eligible facilities within the state, so that all covered entities actually enroll and utilize the 340B program to its greatest potential. Also, to use the 340B drugs for state and county prisoners, to establish sole source contracts with 340B providers to supply high cost chronic care drugs, and there'll be an example of this. The use of 340B within the state-funded managed care plans to pass on savings back to the state, and including 340B providers in state bulk purchasing initiatives.
Including 340B providers in state bulk purchasing initiatives. What do you have states that do that now? You're going to talk about that. Okay, good. Thank you.
This is a map of the United States. It was presented in March of 2004 by the National Council of State Legislatures, and it just shows which states are currently pursuing or encouraging the use of 340B programs. And these are some of the states that I'll talk about briefly next. Texas has expanded or used the 340B program and expanded in different areas, one being in 2001 in their prison population. And Senate Bill 347 authorized the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to provide health care services, which included pharmaceuticals, prescription drugs, to the Texas prison population through the 340B program. They contracted with two of the university hospitals. The prisoners had to become patients of the 340B entity to be eligible to receive the discounted drugs. But they report savings of about $10 million per year.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Currently, our corrections, we purchase drugs through the Minnesota multi-state purchasing pool. Is there equivalent savings to a mechanism like that?
Senator Chairman?
Yes.
There are savings garnered through that program, and many of the states use that program. However, I believe through the Texas program and others, they have found the 340B savings to be greater.
Specifically in drug purchasing?
Specifically for the prisoners. It's something you'd have to evaluate on a state-by-state basis, but there are several states going through them.
I guess, Mr. Chair, the point is, I mean, we do have a bulk purchasing model there, so we need to be very careful we don't abandon something.
No. We're not abandoning that necessarily. We may be looking for a new one. No.
Saves money.
Yes, please.
Secondarily, in 2003, Texas also extended their 340B program into their community mental health centers and formed a referral relationship to obtain the 340B pricing. And, you know, similar partnership strategies such as these have been expanded. When I was doing some research for this presentation, it was noted in this fall in Virginia that the state of Virginia is looking at a pilot project for with a 340B entity for their state employee. So there's different states are looking at it very different ways and creatively, a little bit outside of the box.
Excuse me. Now, does that take a waiver to do that from the feds, or is it just under the umbrella of the 340B program?
It may take legislative changes. That's
well,
you
I'm sorry. Continue. I interrupted.
Around the Medicaid program, it would require a waiver,
yeah.
And many of these may require one of the projects, a waiver through the alternate method demonstration project waiver. So there may be waivers that would need to be entered into by the state with the federal government. Utah has used the 340B program with a sole source contract, again with one of their universities, with the University of Utah, to provide hemophilia factor products and case management services to the hemophilia population. This is specifically for the Medicaid population and does require, or did require, a waiver to waive the patient's freedom of choice. This model has also been looked at by other states to be applied to other high-cost chronic use medications that can be facilitated through a mail order program as well. HIV meds, I believe Minnesota is looking into that. A lot of states are expanding this option, but Utah's had it in place for at least 3 years, I believe.
Hmm.
But again, to meet the definition of being being able to use a 340B program, they must receive other services from the 340B entity. In this case, they were receiving case management as well as the prescriptions.
So, Mr. Chair, so they're looking at, you know, if you got to get an 1115 waiver, just doing it kind of case-by-case sort of thing rather than as maybe a more effective way to approach the feds than doing a big thing?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we could do hemophilia. We could also ask them to waive AIDS drugs. I mean, so that's kind of direction some states are taking.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, some states are looking specifically. They're starting smaller, seeing how it works, and then they may be expanding to other populations outside that. The hemophilia products are are very expensive.
Right.
Very costly.
Well, the AIDS products aren't cheap either.
That's
so
true.
Right.
Okay, good. Thank you.
We go back to there. Okay, I mean we're to AIDS because they keep coming up with new products all the time. So if you're going to get a waiver to allow this program, is it for the population or is it for? In other words, could we get a 1115 waiver to do a 340 for AIDS, whatever drugs are available, or would it be specific for a drug list?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, this Utah's example is for a sole source contract with
right.
an entity, and
right.
if they can use for the case management for that disease state. It doesn't exclude certain products
okay.
for the entire disease state.
Okay.
And the case management around that disease state.
Okay. Thank you.
Massachusetts has kind of used a multi-pronged approach. They are looking at different ways to increase their enrollment within the 340B program to accelerate participation through some different mechanisms, putting automated dispensing systems in some of their community health centers. Setting up networks of both providers and networks of pharmacies for their community health centers. They're also seeking federal approval to enroll the Medicaid managed care organizations in the 340B program to decrease the costs within those programs. And they're also developing clinical support or disease management programs, again, for select populations, similar to the Utah program, with those 340B eligible entities. New Mexico has done a variety of different things over the last couple years, and they began within 2002 a resolution to encourage the agencies to use the 340B program. just to get out there to promote the use of that. That moved in 2003 to a law requiring Medicaid to identify those entities that are eligible to participate. And then last year actually passed a law that mandates the enrollment in the 340B program of all eligible covered entities, those that are identified by Medicaid and others. And they are the first state in the country that has a law that's mandating the enrollment into the 340B program.
Interesting.
And one of the last examples is with Connecticut. And in 2003, Senate Bill 1123 authorized loans, or provides for loans, for the federal qualified health centers for the cost of establishing the pharmacy or a partnership with a community pharmacy. So again, to encourage the enrollment, to essentially help boost that the covered entities to utilize the 340B program.
Okay. Now, I this is so new to me that I don't even know what questions to ask, but if the state of Oregon decided to follow the New Mexico model and mandated enrollment of all eligible health care providers and programs, what would that include in the state of Oregon?
What would that, excuse me?
Well, what would include? I mean, if we decided to go that route, I'm trying to, I don't know who all the, necessarily all the, we're bringing in classes of illnesses, you know, we're bringing in a lot. I mean, what's the scope of New Mexico's program is what I'm asking, all eligible providers.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
They are using their law to mandate the covered entities, so whether it's a TB clinic or an STD clinic or a federally qualified health center, to enroll in the 340B program to garner the savings for their program. First, Oregon would need to find out where their covered entities are, what percentage of them are enrolled, and
well,
then see if this even makes sense.
Okay, I guess what I'm looking at are the spin-offs of this, the creative use of this program, and that other, well, maybe New Mexico is not the right example then, but I'm looking at what creative mechanisms we could use in Oregon to expand the coverage under the 340B program. Now, we have the beginning of a drug purchasing program. I'm not sure, you know, is income and age and poverty level a requirement for coverage under this program? I guess safety net clinics, in a sense, cover poor people, right?
Not necessarily.
Not exactly. Okay. I mean, they can at times, but it's also the family planning clinic, so
yeah.
It's a true safety net of access as well.
Yeah.
But we will get into a little bit. I mean, we have brought up some things to maybe stir some interest.
But what he's got you stopped. I mean, you've been talking about managed care systems, and the FQHCs do the majority of their business is fee-for-service. Is that an issue, or? Or is it because of the FQHC is a system and they're purchasing for their system, the fact that they're servicing fee-for-service clients, is that an issue?
I'm not following. I don't think what you're asking.
Okay. We've got two ways you get services. You're either in a managed care system, or you're a fee-for-service, pay-as-you-go, or if you're in Medicaid, the state pays-as-you-go system. I mean, those are what we have. And earlier you were talking about MHOs or HMOs or the combination of the group, but when you get to FQHCs, a lot of their clientele are fee-for-service. And so the question is, the FQHC is the entity that's doing the purchase. The fact that they're serving fee-for-service, is that an issue? Okay.
No, not as long as the client becomes a patient of that covered entity, whether they're a fee-for-service or a managed care.
Okay.
I guess what qualifies a patient to become
a client of that entity.
They must, some organizations may have their own restrictions. Some of the healthcare covered entities may have their own restrictions. But for them to receive prescriptions, they must also receive some other healthcare service from that provider.
I see. Okay, some other. Okay, I understand.
So either they've received physical health services or mental health.
So it isn't just a prescription.
No.
It's connected to something. Yeah, okay. Very good.
Okay. Then theoretically, our own Department of Corrections or our Oregon Youth Authority, for example, could come forth similar or Texas 340B programs since they receive a full array of services in those settings, right?
Correct. The client must receive other other services from the 340B entity other than just the prescription.
Okay. Chairman Morrison, members of the committee, maybe one way to think about this or approach this is that there probably needs to be some sort of mini feasibility study or some analysis done. I think what you want to take a look at is of those 188 or so entities, in some cases there may be legitimate reasons why they're not participating as 340B entities. Other cases it just hasn't, maybe it's not been promoted all that well, or they're not aware of how to become or enrolled in 340B. So I think the sense is what you probably want to avoid is disrupting, you know, for example, patient relationships that are already ongoing, those kinds of things. But the value in taking a look at it, whether, in fact, I might argue fee-for-service might be an easier place to start, because FQHCs often will be the medical home for those individuals. So in terms of meeting the definition around getting a service there, they're probably going to pretty easily meet that definition. Then the question is, sort of what's existing financial relationships that are going on there? Does it make sense to, in those cases, either require 340B pricing or encourage it in some way?
My sense is that probably the small single provider clinics may not be part of the system just because it may be more hassle than it's worth from their perspective. So,
right. Senator, setting up the contract with the pharmacy and getting all that does have quite a bit of administrative burden that goes with
right.
it. Now, building on what the other states' experiences are, and what programs Oregon already has in place, just highlight some of the opportunities that may be in place, may be there for Oregon, and actually a pilot program that Oregon already has going. I'm not sure if you're aware of, but the Office of Medical Assistance Program, or OMAP, has a 340B pilot project with Northwest Human Services Clinic in Salem.
I didn't know that.
The contracted pharmacy is well partnered. They're a mail order pharmacy. This is just beginning. The pilot is to initiate the end of February, the first part of March of this year. So it's just getting underway. CMS did grant a waiver to offer WellPartner a differentiated acquisition cost plus an enhanced dispensing fee to encourage this arrangement. And WellPartner's savings analysis reported to Mercer was an 11% savings over the Medicaid prescription expenses for these Medicaid clients in that FQHC. But again, this is just the beginning, so that's a projection.
Okay.
Some of the other opportunities that may be out there for Oregon, especially with OMAP, may be to expand that pilot program once it's established, once you get some results as far as the savings to other clinics. Or to allow networks of covered entities under that pilot. Also to coordinate the 340B pilot program with the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, high-risk populations, and particularly the AIDS HIV program. Essentially building on once you have a pilot program up and running and established, building on that pilot program and expanding it to these other areas. And then sole source contracts, similar to Utah, for high cost chronic care medications for the Medicaid clients. Other opportunities, I think we've touched on these basic a little bit earlier, is the corrections. Again, identifying a 340B entity to provide primary care, then including under that prescription services to the Oregon Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority. and utilizing potentially those pharmacies that are already in place. And for mental health, there may be opportunity for the Oregon State Hospital or the Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center to participate in the 340B program. Again, possibly building on the approach that Texas has taken to get a referral base for the mental health clinic.
So you're working currently with OMAP, right? Are you...
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, we've actually been working with the Oregon Health Policy Institute, and we just completed a benchmarking study.
Okay.
So we've worked with OMAP, but we're not directly contracted with OMAP right now.
So have you spent much time in Oregon doing your consulting? I'm trying to get a sense of your ongoing connection with the state of Oregon right now. Okay. I'm trying to get a sense of that. And we should have Barney Spaeth here, I guess, to talk about this. I thought maybe Bruce Goldberg would be here, but he's not here.
So. Chairman Morissette, we just met with Barney Spaeth prior to coming over here, and with Bruce Goldberg. I think they had a conflict.
Okay.
But we're actually ongoing working with the benchmarking project. In fact, the slide you have up here right now, or we have up here, we just threw it in just in case there were questions beyond 340B pricing, but obviously I think the scope of our discussion is 340B, but this was just taken right out of our benchmarking study.
Okay.
So we're still in the process of working through that. Out of the benchmarking study came some recommendations that we provided and just some observations around prescription drug spending in Oregon. So we have an ongoing relationship with Bruce Goldberg in his office, as well as working sort of with OMAP to reconcile on our benchmarking study how those match up with
okay.
what OMAP has.
Now, have you had some direct discussions about our bulk purchasing program, pharmaceuticals? Is that
through work with the?
Yeah. You want to comment on that?
Sure, Chairman. Through work with the Heinz Foundation,
okay.
Mercer has interviewed many of the agencies within the Oregon, including the Oregon Prescription Drug Purchasing Program,
okay.
just to get a basic background to provide that information back to the Heinz Foundation as part of their study on aggregate purchasing and the current policies and procedures that are going on within Oregon. So we've talked to the Oregon, the director, the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Youth Authority, each of those entities that purchase medications within the state have been interviewed over the last initially about 9 months ago, and then over the last 2 months.
Okay. Now, one other question about your being here today. Were you here? You didn't fly out just for this presentation, I'm sure. You must have been here, right? Are you currently doing work in Oregon physically?
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, we're doing ongoing work. I think we came out today. One of us came out today just for this meeting, Boise, so it's a commuter flight.
Okay.
But we do have other works. We had a few other meetings that we did earlier today as well.
Okay, so you have ongoing meetings and work with our program and our various programs. So you will be available over time to
absolutely
discuss
yeah.
and so on. And I feel it would have been helpful if we have had a discussion with Bruce and Barney before you came to get a sense of this whole thing, but we didn't do that. I thought they were going to be here
okay.
to kind of fill in some of the gaps. Yes.
Do you still have unresolved issues with the 3624 benchmark, or is it pretty much a complete thing now?
Chairman Morissette, Senator Cruz, my understanding is that there's a reconciliation of sorts to take place, and that is not yet completed, and so those discussions are ongoing. So that'll be our ongoing involvement as that continues. We'll be talking with Bruce and others and Barney as that process completes itself. And in fact, one of the outcomes of that was to take a look at or suggest taking a look at 340B program maximization, so it's sort of a direct tie-in to what we're talking about today.
Thank you, Senator. You mentioned you had done some work through maybe the Heinz Foundation looking at Department of Corrections. Have you actually developed some like hard numbers looking at the current purchasing cost for Department of Corrections versus 340B to compare what the savings would be? Have you got to that depth?
Chairman, no. We have the report. I'm not sure if the report is in is complete for the Heinz Foundation at this time. We were conducting all the interviews, and I don't believe at that that level of detail will be in the report. The 340B was just one component of it. We were asked to look at the aggregate purchasing overall, and then from that came, what do you know about 340B? Could you please look into this in relation to Oregon?
Good. Okay. No, I really appreciate your being here and the discussion, and I wish that I had had the discussion earlier with Bruce or Barney about to have a more complete picture of what's going on. But we will have that discussion, and mm-hmm. And I think that I really appreciate the what you're laying out for us, because now let me ask Senator Cruz, in your vast knowledge and background dealing with this particular topic, have you been involved with 340B?
Not at all. This is my first exposure. I want to learn more.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, one problem we have had with our state, with the multi-state purchasing pool, is we get into restraint of trade restrictions on how expensive we can be. For example, when we're purchasing for government entities, it's fine, but to go out side of that becomes problematic. I mean, I think currently our entire prison system, and I think our state hospital are all under that pool, I believe. But for us to go beyond that becomes problematic. So if there's a as cost effective a way to do that, and we can aggregate it more, it'd certainly be worth exploring.
Chairman Morsett, Senator Cruz, I think a lot of states have been, all of a sudden 340B has really come up again in discussions, and quite a few states are asking us about the same kinds of information. Still somewhat in the early stages. I think this is intended to be a very high-level sort of educational 101 on 340B, probably not enough to make decisions based upon what's here. But I think how we've seen other states potentially approach this, and I think, frankly, what Oregon themselves have been going through is, maybe starting at a very simple level and saying, all right, of the 188 or so out there, let's take a look at actually how many are participating. If you find that a very large, and that was something we unfortunately couldn't get in time for today, but if it turns out a very large percentage are participating and taking advantage of discounts, you're probably not missing much.
Right.
We might suspect, though, that not very many are, based upon, I think, other states' experience, because it just doesn't seem to be all that well known. So an obvious starting point is sometimes taking a look at that participation. I think there's very little doubt that there's savings to be achieved. The analysis or the thought process, though, is what's the administrative effort that needs to be expended to get these entities registered and do the outreach to get them enrolled and actively participate in taking advantage of the discounts. But I think there's no question the discounts are sizable. And in areas, for example, where you already have established relationships, for example, fee-for-service members already going to an FQHC, those are ideal to make sure that those entities are accessing 340B, because there really isn't a whole lot of work or any disruption that needs to happen. In other situations like corrections, again, you may be looking at making a change and requiring these folks to sort of register or affiliate with a different provider, and then that becomes more of a policy decision as to whether or not you want to require that. But again, no question there's some savings there that could be reasonably significant.
Yeah, about a week ago we had a hearing with safety net clinics of all kinds who were complaining bitterly about the repayment schedule from the state. And I think we're going to resolve that mostly by administrative rule, but maybe some legislative parameters that will not change. And in the course of that hearing at the end, we were wondering if there was some kind of contact person that would represent all of them, and sure enough there was a young lady who just is assuming that role as the kind of contact for all of the safety net clinics in the state, which is very helpful for a variety of things, and this would be one of them, is to coordinate what they're doing and find out what they're doing and see if so. Mm-hmm. I think it's beginning to fit together.
Mr. Chair, my next group starts in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But I Another thing I'd be interested in out of what you presented today would be the steps New Mexico went through with hemophilia, sort of thing. I mean, if we can carve out specific high-cost disease with fairly predictable populations, I mean, it isn't a population that churns. People come in and go out due to extraordinary things, you know. It'd be nice to see how they went about that, because those are high-cost folks, high-cost drugs, and if there's some specific savings we can get just in those populations, that would be helpful. So,
well, it is a minute to five, and we're
Thank you.
Thank you.